agree.
That's one small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Cindy.
This week in history.
Well, this week in history, we're looking at the story of Benedict Arnold, the man many consider inflicted the greatest betrayal of the US Army. How he went from being considered a true American hero to one of the most famous turncoats in history still fascinates historians. The date of his shocking betrayal was during this week on September the 21st in 1780. Professor Woody Holton, Professor of History at the University of South Carolina and an expert in early American history, is going to take us through this fascinating story, and he's with me now. Professor Holton, welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much. Call me Woody.
Woody, all right. Now, Benedict Arnold was a military officer who fought with distinction during the Revolutionary War, rising to the top rank of Major General. He was considered a war hero, wasn't he?
Extraordinary distinction. In fact, they were taken to calling him, referring to his usual intrepidity. Just it was what was expected of him. He led a regiment of men to attack Canada at the start of the war in an attempt to make Canada the 14th state of the rebel states, unsuccessful, but a grueling journey up the Kennebec River where they're having to drag the boats up waterfalls and so forth. Mm. And he was really the hero of the Battle of Freeman Farm, which brought France into the war on the American side, which most people think the rebels, who called themselves patriots, they wouldn't have won without French aid. So he really was, if he had just died in 1778 or 9, he would have been one of the great heroes, maybe the greatest hero of the war.
And he was so revered, Woody, that General George Washington gave him his fullest trust and placed in him the command of West Point in New York. I mean, Washington considered him indispensable.
Yes, by the time Washington gave him West Point, he actually gave it to him because he requested it. And it was sort of startling to Washington that he would ask for such a minor command, because he could have commanded a whole division of the army had he wanted to, or maybe been number two to Washington himself. But he asked for West Point because by that time he was already taking money from the British, giving Continental Army secrets to the British and asking the British, what do you want? And they said, well, we'd sure like to capture West Point, which was not then what it is today, a military college, but a crucial point 50 miles up the Hudson River from New York City. And he basically gave them a menu. What would you like me, the British, a menu? What would you like me to hand over? And they said, West Point. What's not as well known is that he also tried to hand them George Washington just a couple of weeks before his attempt to hand over West Point. Washington, he just learned from Washington, was going to be crossing the Hudson River, and the British had the warships, mostly controlled the river, so Washington was going to have to sneak across. But Arnold, who had been such a great friend of Washington's, and Washington had done so many things for Arnold, he didn't hesitate a minute to tell the British, okay, on September 17th, 1780, Washington is going to be crossing the Hudson River. You've got warships in the river. This is your chance to capture or kill George Washington.
This story you're sharing with us tonight is even more evocative for me, Woody, because a few months ago I was in New York and I caught the train up the Hudson to Beacon, and we went past West Point, and I really had no idea what a huge fortification it is and what a critical, you can see it, what a critical point in the Hudson Valley that it is placed in.
Yes, you could see why the British chose that among the options of things that Arnold could give them. It's beautiful country, isn't it? But in wartime, it's a great place to stop any ships, both military or commercial, from going in either direction on the river.
All right. So before we get into why he turned and defected to the British, maybe we can get a better understanding of the man, Benedict Arnold, his character, perhaps starting with his early life, Woody, and influences that he may that have affected him. So give us a sense of his early life and how it was shaped. Where was he born and what was his family like?
Right. He was born in Connecticut in 1741 to a wealthy family, but his father suffered from alcoholism and lost it all. And this really impacted Benedict in both practical and more psychological ways. On the practical level, he had been sent to grammar school, which in those days we didn't have free public education. And so you had to pay for that. And once his father had lost the family fortune, Benedict had to be pulled out of school. But then also going along with that is the humiliation of having a father that you can't revere and having gone. It's one thing to have never been wealthy. A lot of people who were born poor, you know, take that as their inspiration to move ahead. But he came from a family that had been wealthy and lost it all. And I think he found that humiliating. And so it contributed to his amazing sensitivity. He was so thin-skinned. But I'll also say that didn't make him rare. There were all kinds of duels fought within the Continental Army, that is, between two officers in the Continental Army, because they were all so sensitive about who outranks who, and I don't take orders from you, and all of that. And so there's a lot of ways in which this might surprise you, Indira, but he was sort of the quintessential American, that is, American white male of that era, in being so proud, courageous, give him credit for that, but so sensitive about his honor that, you know, if you just happened to walk past him on a street, then you might find yourself in a duel with him. But to answer your question about his early life, he rebuilt the family fortune. They apprenticed him after both of his parents had died while he was still young. They apprenticed him to an apothecary, that is a drugstore. And then he set up in New Haven, where Yale University is, in 1762 as a merchant, and was also a sea captain. So he learned that trade, which would be useful. He's one of the few American generals who also won or at least was very successful in a naval battle against the British. And that he can chalk that up to having had experience as a mariner.
Yes. Woody, even though his family encouraged him to, you know, take up this apprenticeship and become a modern day chemist, he showed an early attraction to the military at a very young age.
That's right. That's right. And then came 1775 and the Battle of Lexington and Concord. The first battle of the Revolutionary War was on April 19th, 1775. But the first initiative on the part of the Americans, that is the first time they went on offense, was to capture a fort called Ticonderoga, which is an Iroquois word meaning land between the waters. It's a crucial area between something called Lake George and Lake Champlain, which is now the border between Vermont and New York. Anyway, it was a crucial fort, and it also had a lot of cannon in it. But it is significant, I think. People think of the American Revolutionary War is taking place in the East, in states like Connecticut, where Arnold was born. But the first initiative of anyone on the American side was in the West, because they were always focused West, as would be the case in Australia a few decades later, all about taking land up from Native Americans or indigenous people. And so there were very few whites living out around Fort Ticonderoga, but that's what they wanted to capture. And Arnold volunteered. There were actually three different expeditions, and he demanded to control all three of them. They wouldn't let him do that, but they did let him march with them, and they had a very successful capture without firing a shot of Fort Ticonderoga on May 10th of 1775.
And he joined the Sons of Liberty. Who were they?
They were a secretive group of patriots. They took their name from a phrase used in Parliament by a supporter of the American cause. It's useful to remember that that not everybody in Parliament was against the colonists, at least during the first decade. The American Revolution had a political phase of 10 years from 1763 or 4 up till 1774 before the military phase began in 1775. So during that political phase, there were several members of Parliament who supported the American side, and one referred to them admiringly, "Hey, these aren't rebels, these are Sons of Liberty." So the Sons of Liberty took that name, and it operated mostly in the port towns, and it did things like resist the capture of American merchant ships by British customs agents. You were asking about Arnold's business. The main thing he did once he set up on his own as a merchant was export horses. You don't really think of Connecticut. Those who know America think of horses quite rightly as coming from places like Wyoming. But
yeah,
in the colonial period, Connecticut was a big horse exported place. He did that. And he also did some smuggling of molasses in from French and Spanish islands. And so the Sons of Liberty helped him resist the efforts of the customs agents to seize those smuggled ships of molasses.
We are on This Week in History looking at the life of Benedict Arnold and what made him on September the 21st, 1780, to betray the US Army, a shocking reversal for him because he had been known up till that stage as a true American hero. And taking us through this period of history is my guest, Professor Woody Holton from the University of South Carolina. So, Woody, while Benedict was, you know, running his operation, exporting the horses, the British imposed this Stamp Act on all the colonies that caused a lot of businesses to lose a lot of money, and Arnold fell into financial struggles as well.
He did, but not. I think this was not the big thing that cost him his fortune. And this is maybe getting a little bit ahead of our story, but at least as he saw it, it was his service in the Continental Army and the war that cost him his fortune. That is, he had lots of investments, but they had massive inflation. Most of the world today is dealing with inflation, but nothing like on that level. And I think this is one of the grievances he had against his fellow Americans is, hey, I'm out here fighting this war for you, and it's costing me money. I'm not trying to make money off the war, he would have said, or at least originally, but it shouldn't be costing me my fortune. But Indira, can I say one other thing since you mentioned the Stamp Act? One thing that I discovered, I just published a book on the Revolution, and one thing I discovered was that the Stamp Act, which Parliament adopted in March of 1765, was adopted specifically because of something Native Americans, indigenous people, were up to, and that is fighting to keep their land. And the British government said, well, we can't keep having all these wars against the Indians, as they called them, so we're going to send 10,000 troops as peacekeeping troops between our own colonists on the American coast and the Native Americans further in. And it's only fair that the colonists pay for these 10,000 troops protecting them. So therefore, we're going to impose the Stamp Act. And that was the first of the really big taxes that Parliament levied on the American colonists. Their big expression against that was no taxation without representation. Mm. But what people don't know is the Native American role in the adoption of the Stamp Act.
Yeah, that isn't widely known. So 1775, the Revolutionary War breaks out. Woody, what does this mean for Benedict Arnold?
He wanted to get in it as quickly as he could. And that's why he accepted this commission to go capture Fort Ticonderoga. And that was on May 10th of 1775. He then went and I told you that he's later going to be sent by Washington to capture Canada. But he went on his own with just a few men and captured a ship operating on Lake Champlain between Vermont and New York, mm-hmm. and went and sacked a town called Saint-Jean near the St. Lawrence River, He was aggressively participating in the war from the very beginning.
And sadly, his wife dies while he's at war.
That's right. His first wife died. And that's another wonderful what if question, because his second wife is going to play a real crucial role in his treason.
So he goes through these battles. How was his military reputation building at that stage, Woody?
Well, you've heard of that expression that a person can be kick up and kiss down, or kiss up and kick down. He was definitely a kiss down, kick up guy, meaning he got along really well with his troops because they admired his courage and they admired his what they called at the time, and we still today, impetuosity. That is, he was fearless, and he did not know how to go into neutral or reverse. He was always forward, full steam ahead all the time. And you can see why his men would admire that, like we might from a soccer coach or a football coach. But on the other hand, the people above him, Washington tolerated him. Washington had a great flexibility for tolerating characters. But others above him were worried about his aggressiveness. And that battle with his superiors really came to a head at the battles. We refer to them as the Battle of Saratoga. It really took place on a man's farm called Freeman's Farm just north of Albany, New York, which is the capital of New York. And the big battle was not so much between the British and the Americans, who were trying to prevent the British from marching south from Canada to capture New York. The big battle was really between Arnold and his commander, Horatio Gates. And Gates wanted to stay on defense, that it was dig in. He built these great forts along the Hudson River and dig in and wait for the British to attack. That's what had led to a tremendous American success at Bunker Hill back in June of 1775. Was, yes, there's less glory in being on defense, but it's much more effective to be on defense because you're hiding behind a dirt wall in a trench, firing at the enemy coming at you through an open field, and you can cut them down. And so Bunker Hill, technically it was a British victory because they gained the hill, but then what did the Americans do? They just moved to the next hill and got ready to inflict 50% casualties on the British again. And that's what strategy Gates had adopted was, let's dig in. And rather than go out into the field and fight the British where we're going to get shot at the same rate as them, let's wait for them to come to us. And Arnold just could not stand that idea of waiting. And so he he violated his orders and went out with a small number of men and then basically browbeat through begging and pleading, got Gates to send him a couple thousand men. And then once a couple thousand were in, well, it's sort of like the U.S. in Vietnam in the 1960s. Well, we got to go send another 1,000, protect those 1,000, and another 1,000, protect those first 3,000. And then there was a battle. Now, it turned out to be a pretty successful battle for the Americans in that the British had more casualties than they did. The British were far from home, so it would be hard to replace those soldiers they lost. But I'm kind of on Gates' side in this one. I think if Arnold had not forced Gates into going on to offense, if he'd just stayed in his redoubts and breastworks and forced the British to come to the Americans, it probably would have resulted in many fewer American casualties and would have forced Burgoyne, who was the British general, to surrender sooner.
Mm. Which brings us, Woody, to this key date, September the 21st, 1780. At the time, Benedict Arnold, respected American patriot, was now considering switching loyalties at the risk of death by hanging for treason. So tell us about what happened on this date.
Well, before we get there, let me loop back for one second to say that by September of 1780, he had sold out to the British more than a year earlier. Uh-huh. He'd written them a letter in May of 1779, asking basically how much they would pay for information and for him providing various things to them. And he had provided intelligence information to them. One of the fascinating things they wanted him to get them that he was not able to procure, which was the British wanted 5,000 prisoners back from the Americans. These were the soldiers who had been captured with General Burgoyne up at Saratoga. And Washington didn't want to trade because he knew that, yes, he'd get 5,000 Americans back, but they weren't as valuable to him as British soldiers were to the British. So anyway, there was this ongoing negotiation between the British and Arnold over what he would give them. And he gave them a lot over the course of 1779 and 1780. But the big prize, which would be worth 20,000 pounds sterling to Washington, I'm sorry, to Arnold, if he could pull it off, was West Point. And not only the fort itself, but the men in it. And so John Andre, that's A-N-D-R with an accent over the E, John Andre was his handler with the British forces, and he had been working all of this out. But Andre was determined to meet Arnold in person, which would prove fatal to Andre. And there's a big mystery about why Andre insisted on sailing up the Hudson River, incognito, of course, to arrange a meeting with Arnold. I think the reason was that Andre thought his sort of personal charm would work on Arnold, because even though Arnold was working with the British, it was a negotiation. He wanted more money than they wanted to give him. He wanted more solid promises than they were prepared to make. And so there was still some things to be worked out. And Andre thought, I'm such a charming guy, I'm going to be able to make Arnold come along. So anyway, Andre is escorted north on a British warship and then sneaks off onto the west bank of the Hudson and has his meeting with Benedict Arnold. The problem came that they talked too long and it was too late to get back for Andre to get back to his ship lying at anchor in the Hudson without being detected. So at Arnold's suggestion, Andre decides to ride a horse back to New York City, which the British controlled at the time. And he wouldn't be safe until he got to New York City. And riding along with a black slave and another white man as acting as guides, Andre headed south along the east bank of the Hudson River to try to get back to New York. He was stopped by some American militiamen, and then he had a challenge because they weren't revealing which side they were on. But one of them was wearing a Hessian soldier's greatcoat that he knew to be part of the Hessian uniform. And you know, Indira, that the British had rented soldiers from Hesse and several other German states that Americans referred to as Hessians. And so Andre saw that coat and said, okay, these guys must be on my team. And so I'm going to reveal to myself as a British spy. But it turned out this man had just gotten whatever coat he could get. He was actually an American. And so Andre was captured. As one historian has pointed out, the smart move on Andre's part, if he had had any doubt, would have just been to identify himself as British. Because then if the guys capturing are American, then they let him pass. If the guys capturing him are British, then they send him to the British general who, oh, it's you, John Andre, welcome home. You see what I mean? Yeah. He could have played that right, but he played it wrong. And it resulted in him eventually being hanged, but not Arnold. And this is the most fascinating part of the story, because the guys who captured Andre said, oh my God, there's this larger plot. He had some papers in his socks that were drawings that revealed where all of the troops were stationed at West Point. They weren't all in the main fort, but a bunch of them were in supplementary forts. So he had a great map of where all that stuff was, but he'd stuck it in his socks and not adequately hidden. So they found it,
right,
and they discovered there was this larger conspiracy. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, just he discovered it stuffed in his socks. That's all.
Right. And so they said, oh my God, there's a British conspiracy to capture West Point. We got to let the commanding officer for this region know. And who is the commanding officer for that region of the Hudson River? Well, it was Benedict Arnold. Mm. So they sent a message to Benedict Arnold, who was up at his home across the Hudson River from West Point, saying, you've got a conspiracy on your hand. You have to catch these people. And they also sent a message to George Washington, who was traveling, coincidentally headed to West Point for a meeting with Benedict Arnold. And so the question became, who would get that message first, that there was a conspiracy? If Washington got it, he would recognize Arnold's handwriting in these secret documents and realize that Arnold had betrayed him. If Arnold got the message first, then he would know that the whole thing had been discovered and that he needed to get the hell out of there. And that is what happened. Just a few hours before Washington received his copy of the message, Arnold received his and took off and had his American soldiers row him out to this British ship. He says, "Oh yeah, we're gonna negotiate prisoners," or something like that. He made up some story to get his men to take him to this British ship. And then when they got there, he revealed that he was working for the British, and these American men who'd been so loyal to him became British prisoners, and Arnold was safe.
Mm. And so where did he go from there?
Well, he became a general on the British side from there on. Washington was determined to capture him and went through this elaborate ruse of having a cavalryman on the American side pretend to desert to the British side. There was a lot of desertion in both directions. So this guy named John Champ with an E, goes into New York and says, "Okay, I'm ready. The Americans aren't feeding me and they're not keeping their promises. I want to defect to the British side." So they took him. And then his goal was to get close to Arnold and then find an opportunity to gag him and bind him and take him to across the Hudson River from New York, where the British were headquartered, over to the Americans so that they could have a trial. Washington didn't want to just kill him. He wanted to give him a fair trial and then hang him. And Champ did make it into New York. But right when he was about to spring his trap on Arnold, Arnold got orders to leave New York City with a British fleet and a British army to sail down to Virginia to attack what that was the largest of the British American colonies. And Arnold was given the great honor of leading this raid into Virginia. And so he escaped Champ's clutches. You know, Champ had to stay on the British side until he finally got a chance to declare to escape back to the American side. And a little side note to Champ's story: after the war, he died, but his wife was entitled to a pension, but she had trouble getting it because the records showed that her husband was a deserter over to the British, and she had to prove that that was a fake desertion and that Washington had set him up. So anyway, Arnold into Virginia. He entered Chesapeake Bay, which is the big bay that drains both Virginia and Maryland, on the last day of 1780. And then he spent the early months of 1781 raiding Virginia, took a bunch of stuff from Thomas Jefferson. For instance, Thomas Jefferson was then the governor of Virginia and normally headquartered in Richmond, but he himself got away. But several members of the Virginia legislature were captured. But in terms of human lives, the most important thing that Benedict Arnold did during this raid in Virginia was free nearly 300 enslaved Virginians, that is, African Americans who were owned by people like Jefferson. He freed 9 of Jefferson's slaves, 30 and 40 of other people's.
Why did he do that, Woody?
Not out of any abolition sentiment. There's no evidence that Benedict Arnold was strongly against slavery. But the British, since 1775, the first year of the war, had been issuing emancipation proclamations, similar to the one that Abraham Lincoln would issue in 1863, saying to Black people, if, this is a big if, you can get to our side, and if you are willing to bear arms for your king, then we'll enlist you in the Continental Army. I'm sorry, we'll enlist you in the British Army and free you as a reward. And they'd done that, the British had done that, for the same reason I mentioned earlier. They had trouble recruiting their army, that is filling in the gaps when people were, when soldiers were killed or more often killed by disease. And so they needed fighters. And so they, the British had made this decision to basically contract an informal alliance with African Americans who wanted their freedom, and the British needed manpower. Interestingly, more than half the people, the enslaved people, African Americans who joined the British, more than half of them were women and children. But they accepted them as well. The women went to work, and if the kids were old enough, they went to work. But the men went to work as soldiers. And so there was one young black man owned by Jefferson who chose not to go with the British because it would mean leaving his family, because they weren't being offered freedom at that point. But the vast majority of the people, of the black slaves who were offered freedom by the British, absolutely accepted that offer.
And then Benedict Arnold went back into business, ventures in Britain and Canada, and went back to England. And that is where he died in 1801.
That's right. He just barely got out of America safely. He was lucky not to be with Cornwallis when his whole army was captured at Yorktown, not the last battle of the Revolutionary War, but it was the one that convinced Parliament to give up. He had made it out safely. But yeah, the rest of his life was extremely frustrating. He did get support. He didn't get the 20,000 pounds he'd been promised. And by the way, 20,000 pounds in those days is a lot more than in current money, probably roughly the equivalent of about $1 million Australian. He didn't get that much, but he got a lot of money. And interestingly, his wife, Margaret, who the sources call Peggy Arnold, she also got 300 pounds sterling from the king for her valuable services, as it was put, and a pension of 100 pounds a year from the queen, Queen Charlotte, the king's wife. And so they got this financial support, but he had trouble succeeding in business. There was a fire at his warehouse in New Brunswick, and he was accused of having set it himself. You know, I don't know if you have this expression over there that we have here, an insurance fire that is set by the owner to collect the insurance money. And the insurance company thought that, and so they wouldn't pay the cost. So it was a frustrating life, despite this money that they had. It didn't sustain them in anything like the way he had been as a child and as he'd been right before the war. He'd been a pretty successful businessman. He never got back up to that level, and it just killed him.
Yeah,
because he clearly needed luxury, I think, as part of his pride.
Yeah, and the wife you mentioned was his second wife, Peggy Shippen, his second wife.
That's correct. Yes,
yeah,
so a Philadelphian who he had married back in 1779. Sort of, she seems to have been the most sought after belle in the city of Philadelphia. And he at the time was the American military governor. This was in 1779, before he defected to the British side. And by the way, we were saying he was admired as a general. There were a lot of people in Philadelphia who hated him. Though he did some shady business deals, not the last politician in history to use his political power to enrich himself, but he lived pretty high on the hog in Philadelphia, and that money came from somewhere. But, you know, as far as Margaret Shippen was concerned, hey, he can give me the good life. And he's a heroic guy. He'd been wounded twice in the left leg, so he wasn't the able to do all of the physical feats that he had before, but he was still a pretty heroic guy. So you can see the attraction for her.
So Woody, in popular culture now, to be called a Benedict Arnold, it's synonymous with treason or becoming a traitor. After researching and studying this man, are you closer to understanding why he did this, what his motivations were for becoming a turncoat?
I am. And as with any crime, you can usually find reasons that make it more explicable, even if it's still not okay. And I would say that about him. One thing we didn't talk about was that he was passed over for promotion from a brigadier general to major general. And that was so insulting to him, because he thought he'd done so well. He'd won a naval battle in 1776 up on Lake Champlain and all the other things that we talked about. And he really shouldn't have been passed over for promotion, but they had their reasons for passing him over to, you know, Connecticut already had two generals, and we don't want to give three generals to Connecticut, all these things. So he resented that. He resented the loss of his fortune. He, you know, it was no one's fault but his own that he'd been courageous enough to get wounded and lose the use of his left leg. But he resented that, you know, that he, as he said, he'd become crippled in the service of his country. And so let me give you that quote. Having made every sacrifice of fortune and blood and become a cripple in the service of my country, I little expected to meet the ungrateful returns I have received of my countrymen. So they investigated him in Philadelphia for all these commercial crimes that he was probably guilty of. And he hated being investigated. It's bad for anybody's ego as well as their, on a practical level, to be investigated like that. But he said, why are you investigating me? I'm your hero. I've sacrificed everything, including my body for you. You should be carrying me around on your shoulders, not investigating me. And so you remember that line from King Lear, how sharper than a serpent's tooth to have a thankless child. He was like that. He just hated the ingratitude of his fellow Americans. And he hated having been rich and lost his fortune twice, and he blamed his fellow Americans for that. And there was the practical consideration. He wanted to be rich again.
Hmm. It's as simple as that, really, in the end, isn't it, Woody?
I think so.
Thank you so much for taking us through the story of Benedict Arnold. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Professor Woody Holton, who is Professor of History at the University of South Carolina, taking us through this week in history, September the 21st in 1780, when Benedict Arnold, an American war hero, committed this ultimate act of treason and became a turncoat and betrayed the US Army.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.